The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, we're entering the holiday season, as you well know, so I think it's time for us to take a shot at some Christmas stuff. Everyday Heroes, A Christmas Story. A mystery turns into an unassuming couple into Santa Claus. Jim Glaub and Dylan Parker had just been handed the keys to their new Manhattan apartment on 22nd Street when the outgoing tenant said something curious. Just so you know, there's this thing where letters addressed to Santa come to the apartment. The previous tenants received the mail, too. It had been coming for years, and no one knows why, but it's not that big a deal. Glaub and Parker settled into their new home, and for the first 2 years, only a few letters trickled in from kids or parents asking Santa for gifts they cannot otherwise afford. Toys, coats, a doll. Then in the months leading to Christmas 2010, they were deluged. Every day they'd open their mailbox to find it brimming over with letters to Santa. They responded to as many as they could, writing notes, even buying gifts. But they could only do so much. Glaub, of course, is not Santa. He runs a Broadway marketing company. But one night when he and Parker threw a 1960s-themed Christmas party, a solution appeared. Guest, dressed in bought outfits and hippie beads, noticed the hundreds of letters they'd yet to act upon tucked in the corner of their dining room and asked about them. "I told him the story," Glaub says. His guests were intrigued. A lot of people were like, "I'll take a letter. I'll fulfill it." That's when Glaub and Parker realized they didn't have to fulfill all of these letters themselves. People wanted to help. And so was born Miracle on 22nd Street, a community-based volunteer organization that responds to children's letters to Santa with season's greetings and gifts. To spread the word, they started a website, Miracle on 22nd Street. That's miracleon22ndstreet.com, and a Facebook page. Working with those other nonprofits that help those in need, they invited families from around the country to go online and request gifts for their children. Likewise, donors, a.k.a. elves, can sign up to buy gifts for a child or family accompanied by a signed note with Elf before their name, such as Elf Jim or Elf Jody. Both families and elves are vetted either by nonprofits or by the Miracle on 22nd Street. Letters typically request popular items such as Paw Patrol and Coco Melon for the little kids, makeup and bikes for the older ones. One child living in a crowded household writes that he suffered back pain from sleeping on the living room couch. With the okay from the boy's parents, the child's elf bought him a bed. Some letters are heartbreaking. One child wrote, "Dear Santa, for Christmas, I want my brothers to get better. My younger brother has a hard time walking and has to use his wheelchair. I wish he could play like me. I also wish my baby brother could eat like me and not have his feeding tube. I know these are not real presents, but this is all I want this year." That's hard to read. That's a tough ask for any elf, but Miracle on 22nd Street did send the children gift cards and a note. Last year, Glaub and Miracle on 22nd Street helped more than 800 families. One beneficiary wrote on Facebook, "Huge shout out to my kid's elf. You helped give this newly single mama of four the best present. You gave my babies a reason to smile and enjoy their Christmas after everything we've been through. All I wanted was to see them happy, and I got just what I wanted." Glaub no longer dwells on why the letters come to the apartment. Putting in long hours to help the families is what it's all about for him. "It's part of Christmas for me," he says. "It's the same for the elves and families. They look forward to it. Not to do it for would be very sad for a lot of people. It wouldn't be Christmas without it." How about a giggle story now? Department of Wit. You'll be sorry, spelled Y-U-L-E. A husband's fib about a beloved holiday melody backfires spectacularly. My wife loves Christmas songs, and she loves to sing them. 16 years ago, while we were driving on vacation, she decided to pass the time by singing the Christmas song. You know, "Chestnuts roping on an open fire." She didn't sing it once. She didn't sing it twice. She sang it over and over and over and over again. So I decided to mess with her. When she got to the line, "Jack Frost nipping in your nose," I blanched. "Why are you singing that song?" I said in my most mortified voice. When she looked confused, I feigned surprise that she was unaware of her faux pas. I proceeded to inform her that, like many a Grimm's fairy tale, Christmas songs have a dark past, and that Jack Frost It was the name of a violent patient who broke out from an insane asylum on Christmas in 1920s and went around devouring faces, particularly noses, which he had acquired a taste for. She bought it, hook, line, and sinker. She was shocked, no, horrified, that people would sing about him. It's all we talked about for the duration of the ride. Jack Frost antics growing darker and darker as the miles flew by. Fast forward to a couple of years ago. It's snowing outside, and I'm in a good mood. I start singing the Christmas song. And my wife chastises me in a teasing voice, asking for singing an ode to the world's most famous Yuletide maniac. I have no idea what she's talking about. She then confides that Jack Rose, the serial nose biter, had forever ruined that song for her. I laugh and confess that I was teasing that day and that I honestly didn't think she believed me. I was wrong. She got mad. 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 Apparently this had been her go-to fact during the holidays, and for the past 16 years, she had shared this dark and gruesome tidbit with anyone who would listen. As it dawned on her that she'd been cheerfully spreading a lie to low these many years, I guess a sea of confused and disbelieving looks and a flashback of people staring at her as if she were a nose-biter emerged to haunt her. As for me, I am now the king of lies who is never to be trusted again. So much for sharing the holiday spirit. Holiday magic. Stories of serendipity and selfishness remind us of why this is the most wonderful time of the year. Real elves, real live elves. When local kids needed more than toys, strangers started checking off Santa's list. For years, Jesse the Elf had been a holiday fixture in Stephanie Levinson's pre-K classroom at San Fernando Elementary School in Los Angeles County. A veteran teacher in a severely disadvantaged neighborhood, Levinson knew that her young students had it rough. Some were homeless, many were in foster care. Others were crammed into garages or single rooms with 8 to 10 other family members. So she made sure that Jesse, the class elf on the shelf, was good to them every holiday season. It was hard to do on a teacher's salary, but from the post-Thanksgiving return until Christmas break, every day Jesse managed to bring the kids some little token of holiday magic, a pack of crayons, a pencil, something. No matter how small the gift, her students were always grateful. And there was a good chance it would outshine whatever their families could afford to give them. Despite being surrounded by wealthy neighborhoods, their community was so poor that when it rained, kids came to school wearing trash bags. Some didn't brush their teeth because they didn't own a toothbrush. Then the pandemic hit, and the district switched to online learning. Zoom opened the educator's eye to many other physical hardships their students face. For Levinson and her colleagues, it was a peek behind the curtains into their students' home lives, and what they saw broke the teachers' hearts. One kindergartner spent her daily 6 hours of Zoom, humped at the back of a mini-mart, while her father worked. Others attended virtual classes from motel rooms, where their families were temporarily sheltering. On screen, some students had several siblings in the background, all sharing one bed and doing online school in various grades. Levinson began to hear a common complaint. They would tell me they were cold, she says. They'd be trying to type on the computer and could see the little fingers were cold. It was Southern California, so the temperature weren't frigid, but it did drop down into the 40s, and a lot of the kids were working in unheated spaces. Levinson knew she had to do something, but on her limited means, how could she possibly keep all her students warm? She created a simple wish list on Amazon, a blanket for each of her 24 students to stave off the cold. On the Nextdoor app, she made a heartfelt plea to residents of her Well Hill neighborhood. Help keep my students warm and bundled on Zoom, she wrote. She explained the situation, pointed any potential donors towards her Amazon wish list, clicked send, and hoped for the best. 5 minutes later, she got a text from a neighbor. I'm looking at your wish list, the message read, but there's nothing there. Levinson reopened the page, and just like that, in 5 minutes flat, her neighbors had refilled the wish list in entirety. Quickly, Levinson reached out to her colleagues who taught the school's other pre-K class. Can I add your class, she asked. Sure. Just as quickly, the second class was showered with donated blankets. Still more messages came in. We want to buy. We want to help. There's nothing there. So Levinson looped in a third classroom and kept updating the wish list. How about hoodies for the kids? Scarves, mittens, umbrellas, school supplies. Her plea had gone viral. And in the days that followed, it seemed that whatever she asked for, generous donors from California to Texas to Pennsylvania willing to provide. Levin said he'd always been touched by how caring and generous her students were. If they received some small gift, they'd often ask shyly if they could share it with their siblings. If classmates were having a bad day, their little friends would surround them with questions and hugs, seeking to make things better. So when the donations became pouring in, Jesse the Elf joined Levinson's Zoom class to deliver an important message. "I hear you're being good. You'll be getting rewards soon and gifts from Santa." The packages piled up at Levinson's one-bedroom apartment. With the help of colleagues, she sorted the donations and carried them to a distribution point for grateful parents to pick up. Often the kids were along for the ride, giving Levinson another chance to reiterate Jesse the Elf's message. "Jesse brought all these things because you're working so hard and you're so kind. She wants you to be warm and happy because you make her happy every day." And each new morning, Jesse made her appearance on Zoom to reveal what new reward the kids' generous behavior had wrought. Christmas comes but once a year, but giving knows no calendar. As summer of 2021 drew to a close and students and teachers prepared to return to in-person schooling, Levinson started hearing from her pool of donors. "We want to help with back to school," they said. "Do you need stuff? Can we help?" With school supplies as expensive as they are, of course, the families needed help. Once again, Levinson put up a wish list, and the response was so overwhelming that she arranged each of the school's 600 students to receive a backpack filled with supplies. For Christmas 2021, the community again came bearing gifts, and Jesse the Elf did her part by distilling the enormous generosity down to fit a child's magical worldview. So many items poured into the school that the library stood unusable for weeks, piled as it was with packages. Besides the blankets, hats, gloves, scarves, hoodies, umbrellas, and backpacks, the kids received toys, Play-Doh, art supplies, water bottles, fuzzy robes, markers, stuffed animals, books, pajamas, socks, jackets, printers for their classroom tablets, and more. "Parents were in awe of the generosity of a complete stranger," says Jennifer Valdemar, the school's assistant principal. "At the end of the school day, when the cars lined up to collect the kids," she says, "it was not uncommon for parents to roll down their windows and ask, 'Who can I thank? How do I thank them?'" Monique Luna was one of those parents. "I don't think there's enough words," she says. "There's not enough thank yous to give to them, especially during the pandemic when we were all suffering. Still, there's somebody willing to help out a random person they don't even know. I wish there was more I could say or do to thank them." But most of the donors were happy to remain anonymous. Like Levinson, they were not in it for the publicity or even for the thanks, but because their hearts couldn't bear to see kids lacking basic necessities. For Levinson, one of the great surprises in all of this was just who chose to give so selflessly. On neighborhood forums, she says, there's so much slander and hate and political stuff, people bashing teachers. But when somebody like this comes up, everybody jumps in to help, even the people who've been so negative. It's just beautiful. It's just absolute community. I've cried a lot. For the students of the San Fernando Elementary School, the universe is simple. They absolutely 100% believe that Jesse brings all this stuff, and their kindness is why it's happening, Levinson said. I love that they believe this. In the world of a young child, what matters is being kind and caring, looking out for one another, sharing what you have. Jesse the Elf represents a 2,000-year-old narrative in which a severely disadvantaged child, one born to penniless parents in a drafty barn, would go on to teach the world that it's the children who have it right, that our differences are trivial, and that love is the thing that matters most. In our troubled times, it's easy to believe that the lesson has been lost, but it hasn't. It's just that sometimes we need the little children to reawaken it in us. Okay, now that I've got everybody teared up, let's take a little bit of humor. How about some hilarious bad pieces of advice you shouldn't follow? This advice will make you laugh, but you definitely shouldn't follow it. Try to be a rainbow in someone's cloud. Don't ever take a fence down until you know why it was put up. Never ruin an apology with an excuse. Excellent words to live by. Sadly, that's the end of the good counsel on this page. What we present here is advice to avoid at all cost, collected from our readers and elsewhere. Read it, laugh at it, learn from it, but whatever you do, don't follow it. Commune with nature. If you see a bear and don't have time to run away, hug it. Bears cannot scratch their stomachs. My no-nonsense grandfather from Twitter. Drive offensively. When I started learning how to drive, my dad, completely serious, said to me, "Always weave a little and all the other cars will stay away from you." Carla Stevenson, Cocoa Beach, Florida. Don't find someone rich. I was working as a designer at a small company. One day I asked my boss what I could do to advance myself. His advice? Find a rich man and get married. I had a better idea. I sent my resume out and went back to school. 8 years later, I got an associate's degree in graphic design, having enjoyed a successful career in mechanical design. So thanks for the bad advice, boss. It lit a fire under me and launched my life. Luann Smith Townsend, Massachusetts. Plug in. Stop reading. You read too much, you're going to hurt your eyes. Go watch TV for a while. My grandpa, every time she visited. Uriatu on thoughtandanalog.com. Find a mentor. An internship at the White House will be amazing on your resume. Twitter, A. Monica Lewinsky. Improve your complexion. As a young teen, I had terrible acne. A doctor told me that my acne would go away once I married. Presumably, sex would make it disappear. I'm glad we got a second opinion. I didn't get married till I was 34. Brick Weaver, Woodland Park, Colorado. Ostrich Win. As a six-year-old, I entered the 100-yard dash at my school's Little Olympics. My 14-year-old brother advised me to run like an ostrich on my tiptoes, straight-legged. I finished last. Judy Zadowski, Greencastle, Indiana. Pull the plug. My husband grew hot peppers at our garden 1 year. Wanting to dry them out, I asked our Amish friend what to do. Suggested we use the microwave to quicken the process. So we took her suggestion and nuked the peppers. Within seconds, sickening fumes filled the kitchen, driving us out of the house coughing and gagging. Only later did we stop to wonder why we took advice to use the microwave from someone who didn't use electric appliances. Angela Petrokas, New Providence, Pennsylvania. Come up short. It's the thought that counts. Peggy Tapia, Ontario, California. Light up. As a rookie fireman, I was advised by the older firemen to start smoking. They said it would help acclimate my lungs to the smoke in the building fire. Joe Johnson, Santa Maria, California. Figure out your passion. Follow your passion. This advice sounded great, but assume I had some predisposed passion I was born with. I didn't. So instead, I spent years searching for my passion, wasting valuable time and money. I didn't find it, and it left me with heartache. Later on in life, I realized that passion isn't something you're born with. It's something you develop. I wish I had been given the advice to develop your passion. That would have been a life changer. James Huntington, Seattle. Try a new color. You would look great with black hair, a friend told me. Let's dye it. He did, and I didn't. Worst, although the color was supposed to wash out, it didn't. Instead, it turned blue. Dark blue. Almost navy blue. Since this was years before Funkin' dyed hair, I was horrified. Although, who knows, maybe I started a trend. Indy Fry, Duluth, Georgia. Sell now. Oh, this is a good one. In 1984, my sister's husband worked for GTE, servicing small relay stations around Redmond, Washington. He suggested we buy stock at a company that was one of his clients. So I bought 200 shares, as did my mom. We watched the stock go up to around $31 a share and then drop again. Then it would go back up and drop again. My old accounting professor told the class that we had a stock that performed that way. It probably would never go higher, and we should dump it. So that's why Mom and I sold our stock in Microsoft at under $31 a share. I never look at what it is today because I don't want to be sick. KWVRD.com. Multi-use leaves. When I was a Boy Scout, we went camping. My scout leader said to use the leaves to wipe. It was poison ivy. Chris Drew Davis. Fly gently. As my brother left to pilot B-17s in World War II, our worried mother told him to fly low and slow. Terrible advice for a pilot leaving for a war. Barbara Findlay. Be a godfather. Be a Michael, not a Sonny. My mom gives me this advice every time I want to confront someone. How about I probably shouldn't behave like any member of the mafia? Charge it. Just open another credit card. It's free money. That gem came from my friend, who is thousands of dollars in debt and has no idea she would eventually have to pay that off. Go ahead. What could go wrong? And finally, and probably most important, trust me. Now on a totally different subject, nature. A birder's big year. There's a picture of a young woman looking up at a rather exotic-looking, I think it's an eagle, but it might be something else. It's got talons. When she began her year-long bird-spotting adventure, Tiffany Kirsten was lost and lonely. After crisscrossing the country, she wound up with a whole new emotional state. Tiffany Kirsten drove east through Kansas at perilous speed, nervously tapping her fingers on the steering wheel. Over the past 2 days of driving, started in Colorado, she'd watched the Rocky Mountains recede in her rearview mirror. Now she passed through a sea of sere plains. She made it all the way out to the outskirts of Wichita and slowed down considerably when she noticed a county sheriff's patrol car tailing her. Kirsten slowed her rental SUV, hoping the officer would speed past. For a moment it seemed he would, but he flicked on his lights. Kirsten's stomach rolled. Pulling over to the shoulder, she took a deep breath. She couldn't afford to get a ticket. What worried her was more was that only a few hours of daylight remained. If she were going to see this thing through, she had to go, now. The police officer approached her window. "Are you looking for the flycatcher?" he asked. In fact, she was. After flying from her home in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas to Denver, Kirsten had driven 250 miles to Kansas in search of a rare species called the fork-tailed flycatcher. She hoped to check it off her big year list, bird-watching term for the effort to spot as many species as possible in a calendar year. Kirsten was chasing a sighting that someone had posted early that day on eBird, an online database, indicating that a flycatcher might still be hanging out along this stretch of highway. To her surprise and relief, the officer explained that he, too, was a birder. He'd even been the one to post the sighting. Instead of writing her a ticket, he gave her detailed instructions to the exact location where he'd seen the flycatcher and wished her luck. For those who love birds, the romance of birdwatching is self-evident. Birds are some of the oldest animal species alive, little dinosaurs that perch in your backyard. They're widely varied, beautiful, musical, and often easy to spot. Millions of birders track their sightings on eBird, which also contributes to scientists' knowledge of where each species travels. The site gives every birder an individual tally, creating a national leaderboard and gamifying the experience. Kirsten and her mad dash from Texas to Colorado to Kansas was taking that game to its ultimate level. By that day, she was heading to Wichita. She'd already spent more than 2 months racking up bird sightings, airline and rental car miles, and credit card debt. She still had 8 months to go. This surreal moment, chatting on the side of the road with a birdwatcher cop in rural Kansas, was just one step forward in a quixotic attempt to do something no one had done before, spot more than 724 distinct species across the lower 48 in a single year. 2 months earlier, Kirsten was stressed about paying her mortgage and still reeling from the emotional distress she had suffered since being sexually assaulted in 2018. The then 34-year-old had recently lost her job at the McAllen Nature Center and felt adrift personally and professionally. With no real plans other than trying to make some money, Kirsten started guiding small bird-watching tours. She led sporadic birding trips over the past 10 years. As luck would have it, one of her first clients was an avid birder named Charlie Bostwick, who was visiting Texas while working on a big year. As they traveled across the Rio Grande Valley looking for green jays and great Kiskadides, Kirsten confided in him about what she was going through. Bostwick suggested that she go for a big year, too. She immediately rejected the idea. "I have a house. I need to get a job. I need to get my life in order," Kirsten thought. "I can't just run around the country looking for birds." And there's a picture below here showing her with about 8 other people, all of them with big cameras with telephoto lenses. Even beyond these impracticalities, Kirsten had never been interested in the scorekeeping of a big year. Her interest in nature had always been more contemplative than competitive. Growing up in a small town, Kahukana, Wisconsin, she fell in love with birds at age 12 while watching the mating rituals of sandhill cranes in the central Wisconsin woodlands. After earning a bachelor's degree in wildlife ecology from Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin, Kirsten spent a fall interning on a hawk-watching platform in Cape May, New Jersey, placed tracking bands on birds in Hawaii, and eventually came to Texas for a job at the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge. Then, about a month after meeting Bostwick, during a dry spell between guiding gigs, Kirsten went camping alone at Franklin Mountain State Park in West Texas. When it came time to leave, a covey of scaled quail exploded out of the brush and zipped past her. She felt it was a profound sighting, as though they'd been waiting for her. That moment convinced Kirsten that if there was ever a time to do a big year, it was now. On February 10th, 2021, with only a sleeping bag and a tent packed into her little purple Chevy Spark, she set off west across the desert toward California. She realized the journey didn't have to be all about checking boxes. Instead, maybe it was a chance to take on a real adventure and feel alive again. Kirsten started a blog to chronicle her big year, later writing, "I was unemployed, I was seeking birds, I was free." In contrast to the serene, meditative approach taken by many casual bird watchers, big years are fast-paced, intense, and expensive. Birders follow a checklist of 1,128 accepted species compiled by the American Birding Association, with those pursuing a lower 48 big year crisscross the contiguous United States, much like the migratory species they're chasing, in an attempt to spot as many as possible. There's no one standard way to do a big year other than birders tackle all 50 states, Canada, or even the globe. The first few hundred birds come easily, but each passing species is more difficult to find. Big year birders rely on reports from other avian fanatics to chase rare sightings across the country, often buying same-day plane tickets, spending hours in airports and rental cars, and sinking thousands of dollars into meals and hotels, all with the understanding that each feathered quarry could soar away moments before they arrive. All sightings are on the honor system, but the big year birders make every effort to document their finds on eBird with photos and locations. No prize money is on the line, and the pursuit is ultimately a loosely organized personal challenge. The most comprehensive records of the big years are kept by a trumpet player in Chicago, another birding fanatic who has taken on the role of volunteer record keeper. Kirsten enjoyed one big advantage over competitors from other states. She lives in South Texas. Few places in the nation can rival the area's density and diversity of birds. Of the approximately 1,100 bird species that spend all or part of their lives in the United States, more than 500 have been spotted in the lower Rio Grande Valley. Big year birders can count all sightings in each single calendar year. A brief trip to Florida in January, combined with her guiding jobs, had already given Kirsten 286 species even before her West Texas camping trip. She had decided to try the 700 mark, more species than she had seen in her entire 22-year birding career, by the end of December 2021. She wasn't sure which. Kirsten chose Arizona for her first birdwatching foray outside of Texas. There, doubt began to creep in. A windstorm near Phoenix forced her to abandon plans to camp. She spent a few hours looking in vain at the outskirts of a city for a hotel room before realizing it was Valentine's Day. Ultimately, she shelled out $212 for a suite at Best Western Plus in Scottsdale, the only open room for miles. She wasn't even sure which birds to target next. "I didn't have a plan at all," Kirsten says. Still, her species list was growing. Sagebrush sparrow, violet-crowned hummingbird, Williamson sapsucker, rufous baked robin. Kirsten decided to keep driving west to see the California gnatcatcher and western gulls, around the Salton Sea and snowy plovers and marbled murrelet on the California coast. While there, she read a post from a woman who said she had been sexually assaulted while birding. The allegations brought back frightening memories. About 2 years early, Kirsten says, an authority figure had sexually assaulted her at a private ranch in the Rio Grande Valley, and she had been struggling with post-traumatic stress and anxiety ever since. "I had felt nervous at times, but it was manageable," Kirsten wrote in her blog. With this news, it suddenly grew less manageable. Camping in remote locations made her feel exposed. Whenever she encountered a man on a trail while out birding, it was all she could do to stop from sprinting in the other direction. Once at a parking lot on top of a mountain, Kirsten saw two men smoking cigarettes by their car, and she nearly had a panic attack. "Am I being stupid, just asking for something bad to happen? Or am I brave?" Kirsten wrote. "Where is the line?" Beneath her fear was a deep frustration. Kirsten just wanted to look at birds. Why was she instead stuck constantly running through a safety checklist? It was unfair. When an ad for personal safety alarm popped in her social media feed, it got her thinking. Maybe she'd give these alarms to women she met on the road, some small way helping them feel safe to pursue their own adventures. Kirsten sent a message to the company serendipitously called She's Birdie, proposing the idea, and marketing representative promptly agreed to partner with her. As Kirsten made her way up the West Coast, she was surprised by the friendliness of the women she met. Handing out alarms to fellow travelers, she sparked conversations about not just safety, but also other shared experiences, adventure, isolation, natural beauty. The open road began to feel more welcoming than threatening. Female birders she connected with on Facebook frequently offered Kirsten a place to stay when she came through their towns. So far, Kirsten had been birding by the seat of her pants. Now it was time to get organized. She made spreadsheets of target birds, timelines, locations, and backup locations. She sorted birds by geography and rarity. But Kirsten wasn't sure all this was work. Work was leading. I still figured at some point I was going to have to quit and give in to real-life responsibilities, she said. I kept thinking, is this worth going into debt for? But she knew she was healing. How lucky am I to be spending my days, she wrote, not much unlike the birds, wherever the wind takes me. By the end of February 2021, Kirsten had ticked off 445 birds, 503 by April 1st, 603 by May 17th. Over several days in August, Kirsten woke up in the backseat of a rental car near Mount Rainier, drove 4 hours to the Oregon coast, looked at a tufted puffin for 15 minutes, drove back to Seattle, and caught a flight to Philadelphia. The next day, she drove to Delaware to glimpse a curlew sandpiper and a little egret. But within hours, Kirsten was heading back to Philadelphia and hopping on a plane to Phoenix. Even with all her planning, many of Kirsten's sightings were pure serendipity. A snap decision to go in one direction rather than another. Plenty of times, Kirsten counted on luck, that the bird wouldn't fly away before she arrived. But she made her own luck, too. In an effort to spot nocturnal species, Kirsten would set an alarm to go off multiple times throughout the night. She'd wake up and lie silently in her tent, wearily listening for owl calls. On October 2nd, thanks to a blue-footed booby she spotted off the coast of California, Kirsten finally hit 700 species, her original goal. The all-time record in the lower 48 was 724, set by an Ohioan and Navy veteran Jeremy Dominguez the year before. Although Kirsten had never intended to break any records, the numbers suddenly seemed attainable. At the same time, though, she was tired of camping and living out of her car. In total, she'd been on the road for more than 100 nights, and she spent more than $15,000 on travel expenses, draining her savings and maxing out an American Airlines credit card. The rational thing to do, clearly, was to head home. So that's what she did. Almost as soon as Kirsten was back in Texas, her phone lit up with texts from friends in Sacramento and Humboldt, notifying her of two rare species, an emperor goose and a dusky warbler that had popped up in Northern California. Kirsten wasn't sure she wanted to keep going. A voice in her head said 700 was more than respectable. But another voice reminded her that with her record, Kirsten would be making a powerful statement about the capabilities of female birders. More women than men partake in casual bird watching, but proportion flips in competitive settings. Men are far more likely to go on bird watching trips, purchase equipment, and claim high levels of proficiency. Throughout the year, there were moments when Kirsten felt moved to tears by joy and wonder she felt. For a long time after her assault, she'd worried that she wouldn't be able to experience these emotions anymore. Now she had, and she wanted to encourage other women to pursue them. In the interest of self-preservation, she wrote, we as women are repeatedly missing out on solo experiences that have the power to make us feel fully alive. This revelation, more than any sense of competition, was what pushed her to keep going. Kirsten bought a same-day ticket for a flight back to California. She was going for the record. The next 3 months were a blur of airports and rental cars. Kirsten would book three flights, all for the same day, to three destinations where birders had spotted species that she hadn't yet checked off her list. She studied the latest reports online to see which bird seemed most likely to stay in the area and where it had been sighted. Then she'd take the flight to that location, canceling the two other reservations. During a two-day stretch in November, she spent 16 hours in Florida, three in California, and 25 in airports and on planes. Her journey would eventually include all 31 states. On December 18th, with her big year racing to its conclusion, Kirsten found a Smith's Longspur, her 724th bird near Tulsa. With 13 days left, she needed to spot just one more species to break the all-time record. That morning, she got a tip from her friend. Someone had spotted a bat falcon not 30 minutes from Kirsten's house and the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge, the part where she had worked when she first moved to Texas. Of course, she immediately boarded an afternoon flight back home, arriving with only 75 minutes of sunlight remaining. The bat falcon had never been documented in the United States. It seemed too good to be true that this rare bird in this place where Kirsten had such personal connection could be the record-breaking species. She pulled into the wildlife refuge and bolted from her car, rushing past other birders as she took off down the road toward an observation tower. The pressure of the past year suddenly released into an all-out sprint. She bounded up the tower and spotted another bird watcher with a scope trained on the top of a tree. With a quick nod, he gestured for Kirsten to look. She saw it immediately. The striking, velvety bat falcon was flying perfectly, perched peacefully, about 30 yards away. Number 725, a new lower 48 record. She would later add one final bird, a northern lapwing in New Jersey. As the sun set, Kirsten realized she was weeping. Breaking the record almost felt beside the point. It's about so much more than a number, she says. Traveling solo, connecting with women birders along the way. It's been a life-changing, transformative experience, excuse me. She pauses and adds, but I'll never, ever do it again. On the morning of February 16, 2022, Kirsten is leading a birding tour at the Valley Nature Center in West Sulaco, Texas. Two dozen members of the Gulf Coast Bird Club have hired Kirsten to help them spot a golden-crowned warbler, a rare species roughly the size of a lemon. Bird watchers have seen the bird at the Nature Center before, but there's no guarantee that it'll be here today or that they'll be able to find it. About 20 minutes into the tour, when everyone seems to be getting a little antsy, they find their guide pointing quietly into the brush. To the right, behind the tree, she whispers. There's a sudden rush of cameras and binoculars as Kirsten redirects the bird's attention, picking out the tiny creature in a tangle of branches. As the Gulf Coast birders snap photos and jockey for position, Kirsten smiles and lets out a breath. Once everyone has their fill of the warbler, Kirsten briefs the group on identifying features of the next species, a social flycatcher. The birders fan out, looking through binoculars into the palm trees. After a while, Kirsten spots the flycatcher perched atop a leafless tree. It's far from its home turf, which typically ranges from Brazil to central Mexico. It's fascinating when birds aren't where they belong, Kirsten says. I find myself thinking, how did they get here? Are they lost? Are they adventurous? I like to think they just want to explore. She looks back at the flycatcher, which cocks its head, maybe wondering how Kirsten got there, too. In a class of her own, few people in professional sports had a better run this year than former Texas High School English teacher Linda O'Rourke. One of her foreign students, Scotty Scheffler, won the Masters Golf Tournament. Another, Matthew Stafford, won the Super Bowl. Okay, we're going to switch over to Consumer Reports now and talk about something that's really good. Cheese. Cheddar, Gouda, Brie, Gorgonzola, Parmesan? There's a tempting type for every taste, and research shows that all of them can have a place in a healthy diet. Cheese is rich and creamy, irresistible on a cracker, paired with a selection of fresh fruit, or sprinkled over a bowl of chili. There are many delicious reasons to love cheese, and Americans really do love it. The per capita consumption of 40 pounds per year, or a little over 1.5 ounces a day. But as much as we love cheese, we're a little afraid of it. When people talk about their fondness for cheese, it's often in a guilty confessional way, like, cheese is my weakness. But cheese is packed with nutrients like protein, calcium, and phosphorus, and can serve a healthy purpose in the diet, says Lisa Young, RD, an adjunct professor of nutrition at New York University. So if Stilton makes you swoon or you always want more Parm on your pasta, know this. Research shows that even full-fat cheese won't necessarily make you gain weight or give you a heart attack. It seems that cheese doesn't raise or reduce your risk for chronic diseases such as heart disease and type 2 diabetes. And some studies show it might even be protective. Why cheese may be good for you. It's easy to see why people might feel conflicted about cheese. For years, the U.S. dietary guidelines have said that eating low-fat dairy is best because whole milk products, like full-fat cheese, have saturated fat, which can raise LDL, bad cholesterol levels, a known risk for heart disease. Cheese has also been blamed for weight gain and digestive issues like bloating, It turns out, though, that cheese may have been misunderstood. Yes, it's high in calories. Some types have 100 calories or more per ounce, and it's rich in saturated fat. So why is it okay for most people to eat it? Cheese is more than its saturated fat content, says Emma Feeney, Ph.D., an assistant professor at the Institute of Food and Health at University of College Dublin, who studies the effect of cheese on health. Old-school thinking in nutrition has been focused on individual nutrients, like fats or proteins, that either promote or prevent disease. It's not completely clear that this is the wrong approach, but nutrition experts are now putting more emphasis on the entire food and how its structure, nutrients, enzymes, and other components interact with each other. When milk is transformed into cheese, the process changes the way the nutrients and other components in it are chemically arranged. This has an effect on how it's digested and processed by the body, which can lead to different health effects than eating the same nutrients in another form, such as butter. In 2018, Feeney led a six-week clinical trial in which 164 people each ate an equal amount of dairy fat, either in the form of butter or cheese, and then switched partway through the study. We found that the saturated fat in cheese did not raise the LDL cholesterol levels to the same degree as butter did, she says. Experts have varying theories about why the saturated fat in cheese is less harmful. Some studies show that the mineral content in cheese, particularly calcium, may bind with fatty acids in the intestine and flush them out of the body, Feeney says. Other studies suggest that fatty acids called sphingolipids in cheese may increase the activity of genes that help with the body's breakdown of cholesterol. When cheese is made, it gains some beneficial compounds, too. Vitamin K can form during the fermentation process, says Sarah Booth, Ph.D., director of the Vitamin K Laboratory at the Jean Meyer USDA and Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging at Tufts University in Boston. That's a mouthful. The vitamin is important for blood clotting and bone and blood vessel health. Higher fat cheeses, such as cheddar or blue, have the most. And as a fermented food, both raw and pasteurized cheeses contain good bacteria that can be beneficial to the human gut microbiota, says Adam Brock, Vice President of Food Safety, Quality, and Regulatory Compliance for the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin. This good bacteria, found mostly in aged cheeses such as cheddar and gouda, help break down food, synthesize vitamins, prevent bacteria that cause illness from getting a foothold, and bolster immunity. So cheese may not be a cholesterol worry. It offers important nutrients, and it can promote gut health. But wait, there's more good news. Cheese seems to reduce the risk of weight gain, really, and several chronic diseases. Weight gain. Cheese is a concentrated source of calories. That's why portions of cheese should be smaller compared to something like milk or yogurt, Young says. Still, studies suggest that you don't need to skip cheese to keep the scale steady. In one published in the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers set out to determine which foods were linked to weight gain, followed by 120,877 men and women in the U.S. for 20 years, looking at their weight every 4 years. While they found that consuming more of certain foods, like refined grains, such as in white bread, was associated with weight gain, eating more of others, like nuts, actually helped weight loss. Cheese wasn't associated with either gain or loss, even for people who increased the amount they ate during the study. Other review published in the Journal of Molecular Nutrition and Food Research in 2018 found that people who ate dairy, including cheese, weighed more than those who didn't, but the dairy eaters had less body fat and more lean body mass, which is benefit to health. One reason cheese may help control weight is it may reduce appetite more than other dairy products. In a small study, research measured appetite in the levels of four hormones that control hunger in the blood of 31 people after they ate cheese, sour cream, whipped cream, or butter. Among those foods, cheese caused a greater rise in the hormones that help you feel full. Cardiovascular disease. A large meta-analysis of 15 studies published by the European Journal of Nutrition that looked at cheese's impact on cardiovascular disease found that people eating more, the most, 1.5 ounces per day, had a 10% lower risk than those who didn't eat any. Other analyses have found that cheese doesn't seem to affect heart disease risk either way. While many of these studies are observational, which means they don't show cause and effect together, the research suggests that you don't need to avoid cheese if you're concerned about LDL cholesterol levels or heart disease. diabetes, and hypertension. Cheese and full-fat dairy also seems linked to a lower risk of both. In a study of more than 145,000 people in 21 countries, the researchers found that eating 2 servings of full dairy or a mix of full and low fat was linked to a 24 and 9% reduced risk of both conditions compared with eating none. Eating only low-fat dairy slightly raised the risk. Among other people who didn't have diabetes or hypertension at the start of a 9-year study, those who ate 2 servings of dairy were less likely to develop disease during the study. Lactose intolerance. Lactose, a sugar in milk, can be difficult for some people to digest, leading to diarrhea, bloating, and other gastrointestinal symptoms. But the bacteria used to make cheese digests most of the lactose in the milk, says Jamie Ping of the American Cheese Society and a 12-year veteran of the cheesemaking industry. Much of the lactose that remains is found in whey, which gets separated from the curds towards the end of the cheese-making process and is drained off. This means many types of cheese have very little to no lactose, she says. I'm a lactose-intolerant cheesemaker, and my general rule is the higher in moisture cheese is, the higher in lactose. If you're sensitive to lactose, stick with hard or aged cheese such as cheddar, provolone, parmesan, blue, camembert, and gouda, or minimize soft fresh cheeses like ricotta and cottage cheese. For instance, an ounce of cheddar has about 0.01 gram of lactose, while a half cup of cottage cheese has 3.2 grams. A cup of whole milk has 12 grams. The healthiest way to eat it. If all of this news has you ready to dig into a wheel of brie with a spoon, hold up. Even though cheese doesn't appear to have negative effects on health, how you incorporate it into your overall diet matters. In much of the research suggesting or neutral beneficial effect, the highest amount of cheese people ate was 1.5 ounces, but in some cases it was up to 3 ounces. An ounce of cheese is about the size of your outstretched thumb. In some studies, the health benefits of cheese were found to be the greatest when it replaced a less healthful food like red or processed meats. So there's a big difference between crumbling some blue cheese over a salad and serving up a pepperoni pizza with double cheese. Incorporating cheese into a Mediterranean-style diet, where you also include fruits, veggies, and whole grains, and other foods known to lower disease risk, is going to be the most beneficial to your overall health, Young says. For those watching their sodium intake, cheese can be pretty salty. The salt acts as a preservative. If you're eating about an ounce a day, that's not a huge concern. Most types give you between 150 and 300 milligrams of sodium per ounce. The daily value is no more than 2,300 milligrams. Eat more, though, and the sodium can add up. The form cheesesteaks also make how it affects health. Many of the studies on cheese and health use cheese in a non-melted form, Feeney says. We still don't know how melting or cooking affects the health outcomes, for example, eating cheese on pizza or in cooked dishes like casserole. Young suggests pairing cheese with fruit or nuts or fresh vegetables like carrots and red peppers and a few whole grain crackers if you have a slice of whole grain toast topped with tomato. When cheese has a storing role, you can focus it on it and enjoy it more. Is raw milk cheese safe to eat? Many people love the texture and richer, more complex flavors of raw milk cheese, but wonder whether it's okay to eat given it's made with unpasteurized, often called raw milk. Raw milk can be contaminated with harmful bacteria, and it's one of the riskiest foods to eat, says the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The Food and Drug Administration requires raw milk cheese, domestic or imported, to be aged for at least 60 days before it's sold. In some other countries, raw milk cheeses aren't aged as long. During that time, the bacteria should be destroyed. But that's not always the case. In 2016, the FDA tested over 1,600 samples of raw milk cheeses for Salmonella, Listeria, and toxin-producing E. coli. Less than 1% of these samples were contaminated. Most of these were semi-soft tusks, such as Fortina, or soft-ripened, such as Brie. But some were hard cheeses, like cheddar and manchego. If a producer follows strict sanitation protocols and good manufacturing processes, the risk of getting sick from raw milk cheese is low, said Adam Brock of Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin. Still, it's safer to avoid softer types of cheeses made with unpasteurized milk. And people who are pregnant, immunocompromised, or older should still consider avoiding all raw milk cheese because they're more susceptible to serious effects from food poisoning. How cheese is made. There are an estimated 2,000 distinct types of cheese, but they're all made in the same basic way. Number one, cheese produces heat milk, usually from cows, but also from goats, sheep, and even buffalo. They add healthy bacteria, i.e. cultures. Different cheeses are made with different types of bacteria, which in large part are responsible for the flavor. Number three, they add rennet, an enzyme that separates the curds, solids, from the whey, the liquid. Number four, cutting the curds. Removes the whey, small curds produce drier, harder cheeses, and large ones have more moisture. Number five, the curds are usually salted when they're stretched, i.e. fresh mozzarella, or pulled into molds and pressed. Once removed from the molds, most cheeses are aged anywhere from a few weeks, like Brie, to several years, like Parmesan. Fromage facts. The nutrition content of cheese, including calories, fat, saturated fat, protein, calcium, and sodium, varies based on the type of milk used, cow, sheep, and goat, and the process used to make it. Here's what some of your favorite cheeses so you can see the type that's right for you. The nutrition content is per 1 ounce of serving. Brie. Calories are 95, fat 8 grams, saturated fat 5 grams, protein 6 grams, calcium 52 milligrams, and sodium 178 milligrams. Cheddar. Calories is 113, fat is 9 grams, saturated fat is 5 grams, protein is 6 grams. Calcium is 199 megagrams, and sodium is 183 milligrams. Chèvre, goat's milk. Calories are 103, fat is 8 grams, saturated fat is 6 grams, protein again is 6 grams. Calcium is 86 milligrams, sodium is 118 milligrams. Cotija. Calories are 90, fat 6 grams, saturated fat 4 grams, protein is 7 grams, calcium is 200 milligrams, and sodium is 400 milligrams. Feta, sheep's milk. Calories are 75, fat is 6, saturated fat is 4 grams, protein is 4 grams, calcium 104 milligrams, and sodium is 323 milligrams, so it's heavy in sodium. Gorgonzola. Calories are 100, fat is 8 grams, saturated fat is 5 grams, protein is 6 grams, calcium is 150 milligrams, and sodium is 326 milligrams. Have you noticed that almost all the fat, saturated fat, are 5 or 8 or 5, and the protein is anywhere 6 and 7, although we do get one that's higher in a minute. Gouda, calories are 101, fat is 8 grams, saturated fat is 5 grams, and protein is 7 grams. Calcium is 198 milligrams, and sodium is 232 milligrams. Manchego, from sheep's milk. Calories are 128, fat is 10 grams, saturated fat is 7 grams, protein is 9 grams. Calcium, 260 milligrams, but sodium is only 120 milligrams. Mozzarella, part skim. Calories are 84, fat is 6 grams, saturated fat 3 grams, protein is 7 grams. Calcium is 198 milligrams, and sodium is 89 milligrams. Mozzarella fresh. Calories are only 70, fat's 5 grams, saturated fat's 3.5 grams, and protein is 5 grams. Calcium is 60 milligrams, and sodium is 100 milligrams. Parmesan. Calories are 111, fat is 7 grams, saturated fat is only 4 grams, protein is 10 grams. Calcium is 335 milligrams, but sodium is also 335 milligrams. Queso fresco. Calories are 85, fat is 7 grams, saturated fat 4, protein is 5. Calcium is 160 milligrams, and sodium is 213 milligrams. Swiss cheese. I wonder if this counts the holes. Calories are 111, fat is 9 grams, saturated fat is 5 grams, protein is 8 grams. Calcium is 252 milligrams, but sodium is only 53 milligrams. How about a little bit of road report? How driving less affects oil changes? Not driving as much as you used to pre-COVID-19? You still have to be diligent about getting regular oil changes. The need is based on both time and mileage. The best guide is what it says in your owner's manual. Even with low annual miles, change the oil every 6 months to keep it fresh. Be sure to follow the automaker's guidance and not the recommendation from a business that profits from changing oil from you. Get a tax break on a used EV? Thanks to the new Inflation Reduction Act, many used electric vehicles will be eligible for a tax credit up to $4,000 starting in 2023. This is the first time that buyers of used EVs can access such savings. There are a few caveats. The EV can't sell for more than $25,000. The buyer's income must be lower than $75,000 for a single filer and $150,000 for joint filers, and the EV must be bought and sold through a dealership that is registered with the IRS. Credit cards can provide roadside assistance. You never know when you might get a flat tire, face mechanical difficulty, or just run out of fuel. While AAA membership is often the go-to for roadside assistance, you may find similar benefits from your current credit card. For example, most cards from Visa and MasterCard, including some with no annual fee, offer roadside assistance, charging a per-event flat fee that varies depending on the service offered, i.e., locksmith, fuel delivery, tire changes. Bottom line, find out what the services are available with the cards or cards you already have and how much they cost. Of course, keep in mind that AAA offers many other benefits such as travel planning and hotel discounts. The vital statistic, 2 years. That's how far out of date gas expense estimates can be on new car window stickers. The prices, which are calculated based on driving 15,000 miles a year, are sent to the EPA by automakers up to 2 years in advance. So figures for the 2023 model or year are based on lower gas prices from November 2021. For more up-to-date costs, scan the QR code on the window sticker. And a recall, General Motors is recalling 484,000 Cadillac Escalade and Escalade ESVs, Chevrolet Suburbans, Tahoes and Suburbans, GMC Yukons and Yukon XLs SUVs from model years 21 and 22. Buckles on their third-row seat belts may have been installed with a deformed rivet and may not properly restrain an occupant in a collision. What to do? Dealership will inspect and replace any faulty parts with upgraded ones. And let's close out with a couple quotable quotes. Don't waste your purpose worrying about your body. It's your house. It's where you live. There's no point in judging it. Emma Thompson. I try to stay forward focused. Two of my favorite words are over and next. Norma Lear. There can be no real satisfaction in a life devoted entirely to personal desires. If one is to be consumed by passion, I can think of no more worthy all-consuming passion than the struggle for human rights, greater opportunity, and a livable planet. Mary Frances Berry, an activist. Loyalty one way is stupidity. Derek Jeter, baseball legend. Whenever someone starts disagreeing with me, I listen at first, then start wondering in a wrestling match between us, who would win? Patricia Lockwood. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.